Good evening. This is the Voice of America in Washington. Welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Impoga. And this evening we'll talk about peaceful demonstrations. Tonight we have my colleague Henoch Fente of VOA Amharic Service. Welcome to the show, Henoch.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Douglas.
You're welcome. And joining us from Durban, South Africa, is regular panelist Suleiman Mgula. He's an independent political analyst based there. Good evening, Suleiman.
Good evening, Douglas.
Once again, gentlemen, welcome to the show. As I said, we're going to talk about the right to protest, or what they call peaceful demonstrations in African countries. Is it a good thing? If it's a good thing, why are some governments against it? Let me start here in studio. The picture of people trying to demonstrate or petition their government on the continent is a bit bleak.
It is, and I will say to the question that you asked earlier, the right to peacefully demonstrate and petition your government, it is good, and no government should be afraid of it if they're doing a good job, and as far as they're representing the people and administrating a country on behalf of the people, they have nothing to fear for people to come out and tell them what is going right and what is going wrong, unless they have something to hide.
Yeah, Suleiman, why should some governments fear people telling them what people want?
Actually, what is happening is that what we have had for the last decade or so is a democratization on the continent, but which in reality is not pure democracy. We have to question how entrenched is democracy, how committed are the leaders to democracy. There is a feeling, and it has been popularized, that many countries have had elections and they have been having a series of elections. They are democratic. But now what has happened is that after the Arab Spring, people realize that they have got the power themselves. They are beginning to demonstrate, and they are removing the curtain which has been on, hiding the fact that some of these regimes are actually not democratic. They are just using democracy for their own interests, especially the leadership. So what is happening right now is that we are getting a true picture of those countries which have got entrenched democracy and those which have got the facade of democracy.
Henoch, to further curtail on people's freedoms like demonstrations.
I will come to that. Let me just comment on this concept, ideology of democracy. I think of democracy, it helps me to think of it as a skill, not as an ideology, really. Is that it's like riding a bicycle. When you start for the first time riding a bicycle, you fall and off. Then you beat the bicycle itself, and you take it to a corner and smash it. And, you know, once you start to get comfortable with it, then you start to enjoy the ride. And then you start riding it with one hand, and then you start riding it with no hands. And it would just go, you know, on its own, because it's a process and it takes such a long time. Having said that, did the Arab Spring have an effect in the minds of African dictators? Yes.
It did. Shook them up.
It did. But it shook them up in the wrong way. It rubbed them the wrong way. Because if you take a look at, you know, talking about Africa, I like being specific to some countries. The kind of measures that, for example, Djibouti took. The Arab Spring came, this is what we say in Ethiopia, came from, you know, North Africa, then spread to Egypt, and then, you know, Libya, and then came, took a boat ride across the Red Sea and came to Djibouti.
Yes.
And there was a bit of havoc in Djibouti. And the people who were giving advice were folks from Addis. Because if it's next door, then you know it's coming. So the kind of measures that most of the dictatorships in Africa, these administrations did, is they started introducing these draconian laws, the anti-terrorism law. And they have, if you take Ethiopia, for example, we've had this martial order that was passed by the late prime minister in 2005. And it was never lifted, so people don't have the right to go to the streets and demonstrate.
And you must remind people that in that time, many people were killed.
Yes, and you know, the journalist Skender Nagga, who wrote a fascinating letter to the New York Times. It was entitled "From the Gulags of Ethiopia." He was imprisoned because he was talking, analyzing what the Arab Spring, what it means for countries like Ethiopia, countries like Eritrea, countries like Uganda and Rwanda, where you have these autocratic leaders who are suppressing the civic rights of people and limiting democratic progress in their own countries. So a number of journalists who were discussing this idea were put in jail. Some of them faced about 18, 20 years in imprisonment. Prominent political leaders were put in jail. So to answer your question, it did shock a lot of African leaders, but the wrong way. It didn't wake them up.
But Suleiman, these are rights that people should have. But again, people have to fight for their rights. People shouldn't get cowed. They shouldn't fear going on the streets to express what they feel.
The ground is so dangerous. The dictators are so callous. They are determined. In Uganda, the security forces are not afraid of using live ammunition. They have shot people several times. Uganda is one of the most difficult countries to demonstrate on. Ethiopia is the same, the way my colleague has extensively covered it. In Rwanda, DRC, it is just the same. The people are not afraid, but the dictators are so determined. The problem is that they think they can push it further, which is so difficult because whether they like it or not, the people have realized what is going on, and they have realized that once you go and demonstrate, you can get your rights. We had the revolution in Madagascar. They demonstrated and overthrew Reverend Manana. In Mozambique, there was a time when there was bread price increase. They demonstrated and the prices were rescinded. In Kenya recently, when the MPs increased their pay, the so-called MPs, the people demonstrated and the payment was rescinded. In Egypt, actually, Morsi was not overthrown by the army. He was overthrown by demonstration of over 20 million people. So right now, the African population is conscious. The problem is that the regimes are very callous. Unless we assist it, if they can be allowed, they will make a change in their lives.
Why then is it that in some countries you can demonstrate and actually force change, while in others you can't?
That's a good question that you raised, really. There is popular discontent in administrations that are suppressing people, for sure. However, it's not just only what the governments are doing to stop people once they get to the street. A lot of African leaders are actually very smart when it comes to how to prevent people and how to make sure that, you know, popular discontent does not flow out into the streets. They have preventive measures. The number one is any kind of popular discontent. People who don't like their government, they just don't go out to the streets. They need to be organized. And that organization and that structure is provided mainly by the elite. And most dictatorships in Africa have sort of given patronage to the elite, providing them private options to public problems and money. If the school system is not good, you can send your kids to a private school. If public transportation is not working, hey, you have money to buy a car. So for every public problem, these governments have created money-driven private solutions. I'm not saying it's, you know, having options is not a good thing. But those who are taking advantage of some of the gains in that country are the elite. So these kinds of discontents start being organized and manifesting themselves into meaningful political action when the country cannot absorb, the economy cannot absorb the number of elites that they could give patronage and put them under the government, and you know, they have benefits here and there and they have a good life. If you take a look at Egypt, Egyptians worked as doctors and nurses and IT specialists all over the Middle East. And they gathered a critical mass, and the economy cannot give all the benefits to all Egyptians. So there is an elite, an educated elite that has traveled outside, that has taken advantage of some of the experiences, that also understands the realities on the ground. They're the ones who organized most of the protests. So that's the preventive on the side of most of African governments, to stop people from coming to
I see. In fact, where they are, you wanted to jump in before
I want to agree that really the elites have let down the people in all these countries where you see that oppression. The way my brother has put it, for example, when you can't understand why, for example, if demonstrations are carried on and people are fired on and they die, you don't get any protest from the lawyers. You don't get any protest from the nurses. You don't get a lockdown of the offices in protest of what has been done. In countries like Uganda, the security forces have even gone on their way, out of their way to attack judicial institutions, and they go and discredit them. But instead, it will be maybe on the lawyer, but you don't see a joint effort of all the elites. If the lawyers are attacked, why shouldn't the doctors put down their tools? Why shouldn't the teachers come in solidarity? Why couldn't the civil servant come in solidarity? If we have the elites, the way he has put it, the way, like in Egypt, where the elites join and try to support all the efforts towards good governance, then there will be a move. We don't refuse. But the other factor also, in addition to that divide and rule, which is carried under the patronage, there is also the personalization of institutions, because these leaders have overstayed. So you find that most of the institutions have been personalized. It's so difficult to get, for example, in Egypt, you find the institutions are not so personal. They are national institutions, the security institution, the army is a national institution. If you go in countries like Ethiopia, like Rwanda, Togo, Gabon, you'll find that Uganda, all these countries, the security institutions are almost personal. The leader, because he has stayed so long, he has changed them to the extent that the people inside those institutions are either relatives or friends or extended family.
I see. Well, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll explore whether there is a correlation between countries that are a bit democratic and those that are not, and where it's easier to demonstrate. Let's go for this short break.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi, right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there is a youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
Do you love music from Africa and the world? VOA has the latest hits, interviews with the artists, and we are glad to take your requests. The Voice of America has what you're looking for. We have music shows to please everyone. Join us on the radio or on the internet to listen day or night. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on your favorite program. Just follow your ears. Music from Africa and the world. We've got it on VOA.
Welcome back. In case you are just tuning in, you are listening to Reporters Roundtable, and we're coming to you live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington Tonight we are discussing the right to protest, or what we call peaceful demonstrations in Africa. Our panelists are Henok Fente of VOA's Amharic Service and Suleiman Mugula, a South Africa-based independent political analyst. I'm your host, Douglas Impuga, here in Studio 9. Now, gentlemen, is there a correlation then that where countries are democratic, maybe they could allow some sort of people to express themselves openly and freely? Henok.
There is definitely a correlation. However, that's not just the only thing. There's other factors that come into play here. Culture has something to do with it. History. Mm-hmm. Most importantly, history has something to do with it. If you take a look at some of the political histories of some of the countries where you don't see a lot of street demonstrations going on, take Ethiopia, for example. Street demonstrations in the 1960s and 70s resulted in the killing of tens of thousands of young people by the then socialist dictatorship of Mengistu Haile Mariam, the so-called the Red Terror. So many people died. Now, anybody going out to the streets, your parents have been traumatized. The society has been traumatized that they don't allow their young ones to go to the streets. Right. If you take a look at Rwanda, it's the same story. History of trauma. You go to the Democratic Republic of Congo, there is history of trauma, political history of trauma. Mm-hmm. And it affects people psychologically. And of course, as you said, being able to have courts that are going to throw a case that's being presented against you in a court for, you know, coming out and demonstration and calling you a terrorist. If the judge throws it out, then you will not have the same kind of effects that's desired by the government. So all these factors come into play.
I see. Suleiman, would you agree that maybe culture, geography, and even history play a role in these things? People are cowed. They're not, from experience, they know if they go on the street, they're likely to meet a bullet. So why risk life?
Definitely, it is part of the problem, the way you have put it. For example, apart from Ethiopia 205, they had the same problem. Uganda recently, in its past history, people have been fired on. In 2009 recently, people were fired on, innocent people, and they die in number 30 or 40 within a day. So, yes, we do blame them, but there is a history of brutality. There is a history of callousness as far as the leaders are concerned. What we can ask right now is that, is preventing demonstration the solution to the problems which is taking them to the streets? Does preventing them by killing them, are you going to stop the problem? It is a short-term solution, but in the long run, all these institutions, all these regimes are going to be overrun.
I see. Now, given that some people, if you close that door of peacefully demonstrating and petitioning your government, doesn't that open the door to armed resistance, people picking up arms? I'll start with you and Henok here.
Are you saying if you close the door?
If you close the door, yes. Because that's the only, if you close that door, then people have no other option in which they can reach their
Generally,
government.
Generally, when you narrow the political space in a country where you don't allow any kind of opposition or dissent, where you don't allow journalists to criticize you, where you don't allow the courts to rule against your political motivations, then there will be a certain group of people who resort to arms, because you're not providing them with a way of, you're not providing them a platform to discuss, like what we're doing here. You and I are seated across the table, and we have Suleiman from, you know, South Africa joining us. We're having a conversation. If we don't have this conversation, and if people in Africa don't get to hear, you know, a part of the political and the policy discussions, and they're not a part of it, they feel that they're not included, then that leads to all forms of resistance, including armed resistance.
Yeah, would you agree, Suleiman, to that?
Yes. Douglas, I think what we have failed, what the international community has failed to do, is to declare dictatorship a crime against humanity. I think it is a high time dictatorship is declared a crime against humanity. Because the more the dictators stay, the more lives we lose. Yeah. Why should we lose many lives because someone has to stay for power until death? I think because the way my brother has put it, much as they try to stop them, once you have closed all the doors, soon or later, we are going to get violence breaking up. Mm-hmm. We are going to get the Boko Haram. The Boko Haram are taking advantage of the weak political situation on the ground. Mm-hmm. The Al-Shabaab are taking the weak situation, political situation on the ground. Otherwise, if you come in South Africa, you cannot start a rebel movement within South Africa. The people themselves will hold you with your guns and take you. They will report where you are. They cannot allow you to disturb them because you don't have a reason to do so.
So, go ahead.
So if countries don't realize that it is good to be criticized so that you change for the sake of the people, so that if they don't realize that if people are there to correct the government, if they don't realize that it's part of democracy for people to demonstrate, then people will find a way to remove them from power. So sooner or later, we are going to get again, we are going to go back to zero with all the economic gains which we have got. People will take up arms and fight for their rights.
And that's otherwise, the last thing that we need in Africa, really. Yeah, Africa is growing for the better. The economies are growing. And in the future, people will benefit from some of this economic growth. Mm-hmm. And the last thing we need is to lose stability and security of many African countries. And
yes, and as we conclude, some people have argued that people... leaders who fear these peaceful demonstrations are rulers. Leaders don't fear people to criticize them. A leader that won't mind being criticized or being told what people need. But a ruler who thinks like a king or a monarch takes offense if he's being criticized. Is that so?
Yes, well, that's not the principle. You know, leadership is partnership.
Yes.
And is listening to others and is empowering people to act and is allowing people the space to be creative, is giving people the opportunities and the economic opportunities, the political opportunities where people have every right to make a better life for themselves and to run for office to make the lives of their fellow citizens a whole lot better. You don't provide that?
Mm-hmm. And Suleiman, you see, I think is the problem rulers, not leaders?
Yes, unless Museveni declares himself a king and a monarch, unless Bongo declares himself a monarch, unless Nguema declares himself a monarch, unless the Togolese man Nyasimbe declares himself a monarch or Kagame, they should know that this country belongs to the population, not to them and their families.
Even if they consider themselves to be monarchs, it belongs to the people, for the people.
The government belongs to all the people. So if they feel that they are monarchs, people will find their way to remove them, and sooner or later they will go.
I see. Well, I think our counsel should be that let people demonstrate, so long as it's peaceful demonstration.
So long as it's peaceful demonstration, and let's not take it as a criticism. Mm. Demonstrations are not criticism.
No.
It's a way of feedback as well.
Yes.
People are telling you how they feel, really. And if you don't persecute them for telling you, very honestly, going out to the streets and saying, we don't like this, you should be able to adjust your policy and make sure that people benefit, the problems are properly addressed. That is critical. So
yes,
it's a feedback.
And I think leaders should appreciate it because you get to know where you're going wrong or where you're going right. Well,
the worst part of it is that for them, they are not doing anything right. They are already wrong. If you have got your wife as a minister, your son as a commander of the army and so on, there is nothing right there. The economy is being controlled by a small group of people. You are controlling 40 million people, only few who are benefiting. So that's why they cannot accept anybody because there is nothing good which they are doing.
I see. Final thought, Henok?
You know, one thing that I will say is people in Africa realize that, you know, the most important thing for them, and it's been for years, being able to feed their families, being able to send their kids to school, being able to have a life for their children that they didn't have. Mm-hmm. That's all African families are asking for.
I think the whole of humankind would want that.
Because yes,
that's the basics of life.
It's the basics, and they would like to hold the government accountable if they're not benefiting, and if what you have is a system where the very few who are close to the government, and which is actually what happens when you have a big government that pretty much does most of the infrastructure projects, that handles most of the trade of the country. We need a strong private sector. Mm-hmm. Private sector provides jobs and is less corrupt than governments, because there is a business interest and the managers are mainly the entrepreneurs who own these businesses. It's in their interest to keep their money and expand their business and make more money, which hires more people and lifts more people out of poverty. So encouraging the private sector and being able to provide people with the basic livelihood that they need, and limiting big governance.
Well, we shall
government.
We shall end on that note, Henok, and I'd like to thank our panel, Henok Fente of VOA Amharic Service, and Suleiman Mugula, a South African-based political analyst. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining the show.
Thank you for having us.
Our producer tonight, as usual, has been Jackson Mufunganyi, and we'll be back next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. A reminder that you can hear our roundtable on the internet. You just have to go to our main website at www.voanews.com. You can also drop us a line. Our email address is reporters@voanews.com. Thanks again for tuning in. And until next week, I'm your host, Douglas Impoga, wishing you all the best.
African Music Mix.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on the Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. North to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best. Tune in from 0 to 300 hours UTC and from 11 to 1300 hours UTC every single day on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.